Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, the forces, national and global, shaping our jobs, incomes, taxes, debts, the economic dimensions of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write economics columns for truthout.org, a courageous, independent, daily source of news and analysis, especially around economic and political events. I urge you to take a look at their website, truthout.org. If you're interested in the kinds of analysis and the materials we report on and we interview about on this program, please also consult our two websites where this material is gathered and elaborated in ways you may find interesting or useful. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Also, if you would like to communicate to this program with suggestions, with questions, with comments, we read each and every one. Both of the websites I just mentioned and that I will mention again allow you to send us those kinds of emails, and we encourage you to do it. Once again, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Let's begin with updates today that I think will be of interest. The first one allows me to be, or at least to try to be, humorous. This one has to do with the G20, meetings that start on the 5th of September and continue for several days thereafter. You have been or will be reading about them. What is the G20? Well, the 20 biggest economies in the world got together. They began this in 1999. Together, they account for over 80% of the world's production of goods and services and of world trade. So they are the big 20. But they didn't call them the B20. They call them the G20, and I'll leave that for you to figure out. I can't. They started in 1999, and their goal was laudable. I believe the idea first came from Canada, that the ministers of finance in each country should get together to help coordinate and plan the proper growth and development of the world economy. They did a really good job because 6 years or 7 years after they began, the world capitalist system collapsed, indicating that whatever it is they were doing, it didn't work. They recognized that too. So in 2008, in the face of the collapse of what they were supposed to avoid having happen, they jumped up the G20. So it is now not just an annual meeting of finance ministers, it is now the G20 summit, the actual leaders of the world, the presidents, the prime ministers, and so on, gather. And this year, in 2013, they're gathering in St. Petersburg, Russia, a city that not so long ago was called Leningrad. And there must be some irony about all of this, but I can't figure that out either. The big leaders have been getting together since 2008 because having the big leader, not just the finance minister, should do a better job. Unfortunately, the world economy doesn't seem to want to cooperate, so that we are now in the longest, worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, suggesting that G20 ministers and G20 political leaders can't do it. I think there are two lessons here. One, that big multinational corporations are beyond the reach of what governments can do, either singly or altogether. And secondly, political leaders, G20, seem to be much more interested in posturing for the publics back home than in doing very much, because if they were really trying, then this would be a sadder story than the one I'm already telling you. Let me turn next to another economic update for this session. And this has to do with one of our favorite topics, Walmart. The largest private employer here in the United States. With much fanfare, they recently announced that they were spending an additional $50 billion over the next 10 years on their Buy America program. That's right. They want to counter the idea that what you find in Walmart says made in China all the time. And they're going to show you that, no, 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 they're committed here to the United States. So now let's take a look at what this means. If you take $50 billion over 10 years, that works out to $5 billion a year. $5 billion a year works out to 1.5% of what Walmart buys in the way of goods and services a year. So they're making a really big commitment of 1.5% of their normal spending. If that doesn't sound very big, good. You've understood. It isn't. But the story gets worse. Much of this spending will be on grocery goods, products, produce. Why? Because Walmart's big expansion here in the United States is into the supermarket business. That's right. Back in 1998, Walmart only accounted for 6% of supermarket sales in the United States. Last year, 25%. More than half of Walmart's revenue now comes from buying and selling produce and supermarket items. And guess what? That's where their Buy America is mostly going to be. Buying what used to be bought by other supermarkets, but now Walmart has taken over the business. So the growing purchases of Walmart in the produce and supermarket area is offset by the loss of purchases by the other companies losing business. Net effect on American jobs? Next to nothing. What's the story here? Well, it's not just that Walmart is telling us stories designed to make it look good without having it do any good. It's also that this has been repeated. In a recent issue of the Salon.com website stories, Stacy Mitchell documents how this has happened before with Walmart claiming to do a lot for the American economy and then being exposed later as having done a whole lot less. Next update. I wanted to report to you on the exciting news from Great Britain. It turns out that the United Kingdom is about to sell the post office there. I kid you not. The Royal Mail Group that's in charge of the postal system and has been Britain's postal system for 360 years is being sold by the Cameron government. Why? Well, the answer here is crystal clear. Governments around the world, Britain is hardly alone, governments around the world do not want to raise taxes, particularly on corporations and the rich, who are powerful enough by the politicians they buy to make it very dangerous for any politician and any government to approach them with the idea of taxing. So what are governments to do? Well, they're cutting services. You all know that. But another thing the government can do is raise money in a way other than by taxing rich people and corporations. And one of the favorite approaches these days is to sell whatever it is the government still owns. So the British government is selling the post office. That's right. And when the government sells a big entity like the post office, who do you think it sells it to? Yeah, corporations and rich people. Who else can buy a post office? So now let's do the economics. Corporations and the rich avoid paying taxes, plunging the government into a disastrous situation. The government comes up with the idea of selling its property. In the British case, the post office. And it sells it to corporations and the rich. Here comes the punchline. The corporations and the rich use the money they might have had to pay in taxes if the politicians functioned democratically. They use the money they save in taxes to buy what the government is forced to sell by their refusal to pay taxes. You got to love an arrangement like that. Hats off to the British for taking the lead. But of course, they're not the only ones. The Greek government is busy selling Greek property of the government. And the city of Detroit here in the United States is busy selling its property, trying to cope with what it doesn't have in the way of the taxes it doesn't levy on Ford, General Motor, Chrysler, and the others that could pay. Let me turn then to the next update. This one is extraordinary and tells us more about what's happening in the United States than most of the little stories I bring to your attention each week. And this has to do with both economic corruption and social corruption. And I have as my news source an unusual document, the New York Daily News, not a paper I quote very often. But on August 9th, it did a good job. And here's what it told. It told about a luxury apartment being built in New York City. There are many of those. And it turns out that the developers, an Extel Development Corporation, do what many developers do. They try to make more profit out of building luxury apartments by getting special tax breaks. And in the usual way, here's what the New York Daily News reported. Back in January of 2013, under the leadership of Governor Cuomo here in New York State, a bill was passed that specifically exempted five developers of luxury buildings in New York from the usual tax rates, gave them a tax break. Let me remind you, this is at a time when the governor and people like him are telling us we're in a crisis situation, the government can't afford to bus school children to their classrooms or take care of the poor or cover the costs of hospitals, we're in a fiscal crisis, etc., etc., etc. They gave tax breaks to the developers of luxury apartments. But the story gets much better. A couple of weeks after the bill passed, two corporations associated with Extel Development contributed a total of $100,000 to the Democratic Party and the war chest of Governor Cuomo. Uh-oh, but the story gets better. It turns out that the building in question being built by the Extel developers is a 33-story monstrosity on Riverside Drive in Manhattan. It is scheduled to have 219 condominium apartments going for $1 million or more. But in order to qualify for the tax cut of that bill that was passed, they also will have, in addition to their 219 multi-million dollar condos, 55 apartments for affordable rents that start at $845 a month. That's right. They're going to allow poor people. And here comes the best part. The building has two doorways. One doorway, very modestly decorated, is for the poor. And the other one, with 24-hour doorman, flowers in the vase, beautiful music, I don't know, maybe elves will dance on the carpets. Who knows? Two doorways for those in the million-dollar condos, luxury. And for the rest, come in the back door. That's not economic corruption anymore. That's not political corruption. That's social corruption. That's a society breaking into rich and poor and making sure they don't have to look at each other when they go in and out of their homes. Think about it. If we had the time, and if this program were longer, I'd stop here and I'd play the national anthem just so we could enjoy it. Final short update before I turn to our guest for today's program. This one has to do with a piece of news from the Wall Street Journal and several other publications that announced that the six biggest banks here in the United States released a figure for the amount of money they have had to spend on lawyers and settlements having to do with the economic crisis we're still in. That is, illegal activities they got involved in, restitution they had to make, and lawyers' fees they had to pay. Total, for just the top six banks, American banks. Doesn't count the European and other banks located in the United States who've also had these expenses, and it doesn't count all the other banks in America. Just the top six. Ready? $103 billion since 2008 to the present. A staggering amount of money spent by banks to try to offset the illegal and the unethical and the costly waste of resources their behavior has imposed. If I had more time, we'd talk about the rising fees bankers are charging to recoup that money. But I'd rather go in a different direction. I wanted to compare the last 8 years of all the costs for legal fees and restitution of the people that they have to compensate because they misled them. I'm being as polite as I know how. I wanted to compare that with the bankers' bonuses in 1 year. 2009, arguably the worst year of the crisis. In that 1 year, the bonuses were $140 billion. Over the last 5 years, the total legal outlays of these biggest banks, $103. Get the picture? Why not pay these fees if the money you can make along the way dwarfs them? So it's not just a waste. It's an encouragement to do more of this, isn't it? It's the proverbial slap on the wrist. Okay, folks, so much for the updates for today. I want to turn now and introduce my guest. Steve, come on a little closer. This is Steve Lambert, folks. And I want to first thank you, Steve, for joining me today.
It's great to be here.
And let me tell you a little bit about Steve before we jump into our questions. First of all, Steve had an unusual mother and father. And that probably explains most of the interesting things about Steve, as it does for most of us. Steve's father was a former Franciscan monk, and his mother an ex-Dominican nun. And Steve explains that they imbued in him the values of dedication, study, poverty, and service to others. Qualities he feels perfectly prepared him to be the kind of artist you're going to discover he is. He's also the founder of the Center for Artistic Activism, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. He has discussed his work, just so you know how well known he is, on NPR, the BBC, and CNN. He has been his work has been reported on internationally in outlets including the Associated Press, the New York Times, the Guardian, Harper's Magazine, The Believer, Good, Dwell, Art News, Punk Planet, and Newsweek. That's quite a collection. He is an assistant professor of art at the State University of New York in Purchase, New York. And he also closes his short biography that you can find if you check him out by saying that he dropped out of high school in 1993. Reminds me of Albert Einstein's famous remark that he got through high school without being distracted by nonsense and is grateful for that. Here's a couple of things about Steve before we jump in. First, a statement by him. For me, art is a bridge that that connects uncommon, idealistic, or even radical ideas with everyday life. I carefully craft various conditions where I can discuss these ideas with people and have a mutually meaningful exchange. I want my art to be relevant to those outside the gallery, say at the nearest bus stop, to reach them in ways that are engaging and fun. Okay. Steve Lambert, artist. I encountered him, and I thought this might be of interest to some of you, because of an installation, a work of art that he moves around the country with, and that has to do with talking about capitalism, our economic system. And he directly engages the viewers of his art installation by asking them whether they agree or not that capitalism works for them. I'm a professional economist, and here's what I was struck with. The profession of which I'm a part, economics, has been unable to have a discussion about capitalism. It has been afraid, cowardly would not be too strong a word, to undertake the kind of debate about the economic system we live in that is 50 years overdue. What are its strengths? What are its weaknesses? Does it work, in fact? And if so, how? Economists ought to be debating that all the time, especially at a time when this economic system has thrown tens, if not hundreds of millions of people out of work and is providing grief and suffering on a scale that is global and horrendous. Still no, the economists can't be bothered. So guess what? We need artists in our culture to bring to our attention, to open the debate that the social scientists in our society remain too cowardly to entertain, with a few exceptions. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So let's begin by jumping right in, and let me ask you about what brought us together, which is a remarkable arts festival here in New York City that's been going on for some years. This year it's called Crossing the Line. Tell us a little bit about this festival and your particular role in it.
Yeah, so the festival's, I think, happened for a few years. It's put on by the French Alliance, and the festival itself has nothing to do with France or the French. It's just they want to put on an amazing arts festival in New York City. And so they have different dance performances and public performances, and they contacted me because they wanted to include this Capitalism Works for Me sign in the festival this year.
And tell us a little bit about that. Describe the sign and your idea.
So it's a 20-foot long, 9-foot tall sign with lights in it that says Capitalism Works for Me. And it has a scoreboard in it. So on either the left side and the right side, it says true and false. And then there's a podium where you can hit a button that also says true and one that says false. When you press the true button, it changes the number on the true side. If you press the false button, it changes the numbers on the false side. And so you can see how many people in that area thought that capitalism worked for them or didn't work for them.
And what's your idea? Tell me what it is you want to see happen. What is your thought about the what some people call the takeaway? That is, a person sees this,
yeah.
A person is drawn to express his or her view,
yeah.
And what is it you want that person to take away from that experience?
Yeah. So you think about economics and capitalism a lot, and probably the people who listen to this show think about it more than most people, right? You probably are not the audience for this piece. So the people I'm trying to reach, I think that have a lot of, most people, I think, have this gut reaction of capitalism, America, the Constitution, all these things are knitted together. And the idea of whether or not it works isn't really a question. It's how you make it work or you know, I don't know. It's like that part of our society isn't really a choice. So how do you start a conversation with people that don't even realize that that's a topic? And so for me, you know, my go-to thing is a giant spectacle with flashing lights, draw them in, and then before they know it, they're thinking about one of the most difficult topics that there is to sort of consider in our culture right now. And you know, prior to, I think, thinking that through, it's very simple. It's like capitalism, yes, you know, and then when they have to choose in my life, true or false, does it work, and they don't get to nuance that at all, you know, then it opens up a space where that can be unpacked.
You know, it strikes me listening to you, word for word, a really good organizer would say the same thing, that the job of an organizer is to begin to facilitate people's recognizing the issues that really shape their lives and thinking about them and being able to think critically about them. And the techniques of an organizer might not be expressed in the same words, but it's the same project or something very, very close to it. Okay. Let me ask you the question that I've always, as a person on the left, always wondered about. Do you consider your art politically or socially engaged? I mean, it may seem an obvious question, but I want to hear you talk a bit about your art and your view of how it's connected to the social and political issues of your time.
Yeah. This is like a loaded question, because in the art world, or, you know, there are many art worlds, but that's how you're pigeonholed. You know, if, like, you're a political artist, sometimes it can be good. Most of the times it's not good.
Yeah.
When they say, oh, this person, you know, is socially engaged, it's there's some negative associations. I don't like to think of it that way. Like, I didn't set out to say, I'm going to be a political artist. I think I just had certain values, and there was a time when I realized, oh, I can do whatever I want. You know, like, as an artist, I can make whatever I want. I can, and it doesn't have to be like the art that I saw before, you know? So I understand the history of painting, and I can talk about it, I can defend it, and I can tell you why certain paintings are really important and what they're doing. But for me to try to make that work would feel really disingenuous. So there's things in my life that are really important, like, you know, the biggest issue I think facing our culture, which is, you know, how this economic system is affecting everyone, and that we can imagine new ways that the world can work, and that imagination is being stifled, right? So it's not, I think it comes naturally out of being a citizen or something, or just being a person that's engaged in the world, and when you feel like you can affect it, why not?
Okay, very good. If I could just make a comment, I've always been offended by the notion that there ought to be some pejorative, some negative association by political or engaged art. If the point is to say that there are works of engaged in political art that aren't very good, I don't dispute that.
Sure.
But that's not interesting, because it's true about any kind of art.
Yeah,
any genre you pick will have bad work, or mechanical work, or trivial work, or unsophisticated. I mean, whatever words you want.
Yeah.
So, but it's not a peculiar quality.
The peculiar quality
of political. It's a way to put that kind of art down. It's
well,
a way to push it out of the picture. And it's harder to sell, which is another way of killing it off.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of value that's put on artwork that makes it in the marketplace.
Right.
It gets a certain amount of attention.
Tell me a little bit about that. Is that, you know, as a person who works in the art world, who teaches art, who's caught up in it, to what extent is the market an arbiter of what becomes, quote unquote, artistically valued?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ways, and we could talk about this for the rest of the show. One way is that if something makes its way into a collection, the way that the art world works now is, you know, you'll go to a museum sometimes and they say, we're going to show the so-and-so collection, the Wolf collection, right? And this is all the work that you...
Very small room would be.
Yeah. a supposedly incredibly wealthy person, you know, that had this eye and chose the right people at the right time and put together a collection of work that reflected their interests, right? Put crudely, the only thing that makes this person qualified is that their ability to write checks. You know, like, they're a wealthy person that bought all this stuff and put it together, and then someone said, "Oh, you have a nice, interesting collection." But there's all these political things that happen behind the scenes, which is they'll loan the work to the museum at 49% loan, so they still technically own it, but they get to write off the 49% part of it. The museum doesn't have to do any curatorial work; they make that board member happy. Usually, that board member donates a bunch of money to have that show happen. That's really just a big ego stroke. Anyway, that's one way, and there's a lot, you know, just the way that if something sells big at an auction or a show sells out, you know, everyone kind of makes note of that without realizing that doesn't mean that the work is good or not. It just means someone paid for it,
right?
You know,
and given who the rich folks are who collect and who do all this, it's reasonable to assume that their interest in politically critical work is not going to be at the forefront of their choice of what to buy.
Well, you know, people
not
would surprise
always.
You sometimes. You know, like, I've been surprised at people that buy my work and, like, they're sort of political, you know, like they might have a lot of money and still have really great politics and understand that it's complicated and that they shouldn't, you know.
Right.
And in fact, when I'm showing this piece at the Crossing the Line Festival, there are going to be millionaires that are going to come and talk to people about economics. We worked with United for a Fair Economy, and they're bringing members of responsible wealth, which are people who are in the top 5% income bracket in the U.S. and think that that's against their best interest, mm-hmm. that the economic system is against their best interest. So they're going to come and talk to people. So anyway, you always have these exceptions. But I actually was talking to a gallery last night, and he said something to me, which, if I remember right, was, your work would be bought by a very particular type of person.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not sure how deep that euphemism goes. But
well, before we take our mid-interview break, mm-hmm. your story reminds me of the very famous trio of Mexican muralists, Diego Rivera, mm-hmm. Orozco, and Siqueiros, the three great muralists of Mexico, all of whose work, or much of whose work, was purchased by the Rockefeller family mm-hmm. and others, so that even though in their murals they displayed workers carrying pitchforks and Trotsky and Lenin and celebrating revolution against the evil capitalists,
yeah.
they had understood that these were great works of art and purchased them anyway and put them in their buildings and in their homes.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's a complicated story. We're going to take our typical mid-program break now, folks. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
It's empty in the valley of your heart. The sun, it rises slowly as you walk away from all the fears and all the faults you've left behind. The harvest left no food for you to eat.
Welcome back, folks. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, your host, and I'm continuing our interview with artist Steve Lambert, whose work is on display as part of the Crossing the Line Artistic Festival running in the second half of September and into October in New York City. Steve, let's pick up just where you left off. Tell me about this Center for Artistic Activism that you helped form. What's the idea? What's the project that engages the artists that are part of that?
It's a nonprofit I started with Steve Duncombe, who's an NYU professor, and we started it a few years ago because both of us, he, you know, more coming from sociology and as an activist, and me as an artist that was doing the kind of work I was doing, we were looking at this work that blended art and activism. And both kind of curious, like, how do we know that it works? Like, we have a feeling that it works. How do we test it, right? And so we started getting people together and interviewing them and having them teach each other, both as a way for them to help each other, but also for us to better understand this. And then that turned into a series of workshops. We do one called the School for Creative Activism, where we work with grassroots activists and teach them how to use creativity in their work, which some of them are already doing. In a way, it's like allowing them to do it more and showing them how to be more effective with it. And then we do another thing called the Arts Action Academy that's the same thing but for artists. So artists that want to do politically engaged work but need some lessons in organizing.
I find this fascinating because it seems to me, and that's one of the reasons I was eager to have you on the program, that the breakdown of the economic system we're living in is doing what you would expect in 1,000 areas of social life, in the arts, in workplaces, in schools, in every kind of institution. People are being shaken by, as you put it earlier, the implications and the impact of this economic breakdown, and are looking to find ways within their own interests and specializations to engage that, yeah. to change it and react. I think it's extraordinarily positive and hopeful, and at least for myself, I want to say that it's wonderful to learn about this and to participate in this. And I think that to whatever extent folks like us can encourage this activity, mm-hmm. it will benefit not only the society as a whole, but react and stimulate and provoke and mobilize actions across the society. My hope is that people will see that installation and recognize that we ought to be discussing whether capitalism works or not. And maybe the economics profession will finally get off of its complacent rear end and be doing what it ought to have been doing all along. And I think, I just want to congratulate the art community that gathers in these kinds of projects.
Thanks. Yeah.
Very wonderful to hear. Okay. Tell me, if I can push you a little bit to speculate, where is this going? What is it you expect or hope might evolve in the way of the public, let's call it, the American public responding to this kind of work? Mm-hmm. What's your hope? What do you imagine emerging in this country?
Well, being really practical about maybe the audience that's in front of the sign, I borrow a lot of different theories about how people change their minds. And, I think the idea of, like, direct debate has kind of been debunked. You know, that usually just embeds people in the thoughts they already have. And when you can create a space where they can explore something else, you know, catch them by surprise, like in a public center with this giant sign, there's an opportunity there for them to consider something that's outside of this sort of head-to-head debate, right? And so there's a lot of other steps that need to happen, and I think the mistake that a lot of artists or the sort of terrible political artists that we were mentioning before is that there's a myth, a really strong myth, that if I show you this incredibly powerful, image, that you will be transformed. You will see this piece and go from being someone who had no idea that this was happening to completely engaged, that you'll see the horror or something and then be motivated to act.
Right.
And that the process that people go through in changing is much slower. And so the sign is really, I set out to make a piece about capitalism that wouldn't turn people away. And it's a topic, like I've said many times, like walking up to someone and asking them to talk about capitalism is like saying, "Can I talk to you about Jesus?" Yeah. And they're like, "Well, I don't have a lot of time right now. Who are you? Is this gonna? Are you gonna be asking me for a donation? Like, what organization are you with? How long is this gonna take?" So there's a lot of reasons people don't want to have that conversation. A lot of bad experiences maybe they've had in the past, and so the sign is meant to do that first step, get them considering, thinking about it, having a conversation. There's people that walk by and then come back. They know. Didn't talk to me. They didn't even vote at the sign, but they say, "Oh, we were talking about this thing all during lunch." So then from there, other works, other things need to happen for them to move on it. But that first step is so critical with an issue like this.
And do you think the American people are coming? What's your experience? I understand you've shown this in a number of cities for the last couple of years. Tell us a little bit about how that went.
Okay, so when I started doing this was just over 2 years ago. So Occupy hadn't happened. And so the idea of talking about economics in public sphere was even more foreign. And then to see... when Occupy started to happen, I was like, wait, now this makes my piece null and void, we're starting the conversation. And but then I quickly realized that the people that I was engaging with weren't necessarily going to show up at an encampment and ask questions, So it's come a long way, even just in the last 2 years. For me to predict what will happen, I don't know. But there's a softening, There's like an openness to other ideas. There's also a hardening on it with certain people, Like even more resistance and fear.
Can you give us a couple of examples of cities where positive and negative, a little bit of a feeling for it?
Well, every city has that. Cedar Rapids, which was where I was most recently in Iowa, I had some of the most vehement defenders of capitalism. All male, all white hair, all, just angry that I was even asking this question. And the irony is that Iowa gets the most, like, billions of dollars every year in corn subsidies. Cedar Rapids itself has been bailed out because of flooding. And so there's a huge population there that had their homes bought by the government because they were destroyed, you know, or I shouldn't say bought, reimbursed, you know. And the whole city is being revitalized through flood money. And they would stand there and say, capitalism works. You know, like, you've got to work hard. You got to do these things. And so, and it was like, I don't argue with people. Yeah. I just try to talk to them and figure out where they're at and kind of soften and move, right? So someone comes and says, capitalism is the only, you know, there are no other systems. And I'll say, what about something better? And they're like, well, what's better? I'm like, I don't know. What do you think? You know? And then sometimes that works. In Cedar Rapids, it made them angry. You know?
And an example where it went the other way?
I had one guy in Boston missing a front tooth explaining to me how capitalism worked for him. And I was like, there's more here, you know. And so he was talking about how all the other economic systems had failed and that this one was the best because it did this and this. And as he went on and on, after a few minutes, he started to explain how it didn't really work for him. And you could just see he was thinking out loud. And then at the end, he's like, so I guess in the end, it doesn't really work for me. You know, so he completely shifted in about a two-minute span.
And do people react to you personally as the artist in these conversations?
Sometimes. I think they're just surprised that I'm there. They're like, you did that, you know, and as if I was some kind of minor celebrity or something, which is nice because then they're more respectful. You know, they're like, I can catch them off guard and get them thinking more, or ask them a question that maybe they wouldn't be responsive to if I just, again, walked up to them on the street. But yeah, like, I try to make a game of it, and I have some experience with comedy and stuff, so that helps being able to keep things, keep them thinking instead of it turning into an argument.
How about your students in your classes? Would you say that students that are interested in taking a course in art are open to politically engaged art these days, more or less than in the past? Mm-hmm. How does that strike you in terms of your own experience?
There's always some that are great. The thing that happens when you're learning art is that it'd be like learning how to read and write, right? But you're learning like a visual language or, you know, audiovisual or something. And so in the beginning, they're learning how to, words, you know, individual words. How do I draw realistically? How do I draw not realistically? How do I use the equipment and the tools? And then they start to put sentences together. A lot of them stop there. You know, they don't realize they now have a language that they can communicate to people with. And if they do, a lot of times are scared by that. What do I have to say? You know, like, what am I going to tell people? And they kind of back away. And so what I try to do is, you know, help them figure out what's important to them, what they want to communicate, and then also be engaged in the world and find things to respond to, and then incorporate that in their work.
Last question we have time for, and the hardest one maybe. And you touched on it earlier, but I would like you to talk a little bit more for our audience. How do you account for your own trajectory? How did you end up becoming someone who does socially engaged, politically activist art in a society where most artists don't follow that path, don't arrive at that situation? Why you? And maybe it goes back to the biography in which you begin with your mother and father, which is, as any good Freudian knows, the right place to start. But how do you, in any case, how do you account for it? How do you explain your trajectory as an American artist to this point?
Well, in hindsight, I can go back and, you know, say, I don't think my parents are grooming me to become what I became.
Clearly.
And, you know, I can look at my brother and sister. They didn't turn into, they're not artists. You know, my brother's a mechanic. So it wasn't that. And I can look at other different events that happen. And, of course, they're all together. But it's kind of like how anybody becomes who they are as an adult. There's not like a set of college courses you can take to become you, you know. Yeah, there's courses that would help, but then there's a gap between your education or your background and who you are. And you thank God, because, you know, like, that's where all the interesting stuff happens. So I think about that question, and how do I create a path where it's okay for someone to do this? Because in the arts, a lot of times people don't realize that this is possible or think it's untenable. So I can give them the first part, you know, lead some of the way, but the rest of it they have to do themselves. And, you know, it's similar to what the sign does, which is like create a space where that's okay. Create a space where that conversation is all right, or being that, or saying those things, or realizing when you have a voice, you can use it, that that's okay.
Good. Thank you very much, Steve. It's been a great pleasure, and thank you very much for coming. Before we turn to the last portion of today's program, let me urge all of you that have found this interesting to check into the Crossing the Line Arts Festival here in New York. It's an interesting arts festival, but it is, for me, most interesting that in arguably one of the central locations of the United States, Times Square, 42nd Street in Manhattan, you will see, starting, if I remember, the 20th of September, a huge lit-up sign saying, "Capitalism works for me," and you get to vote yes or no. Something is happening in a country that realizes it needs to look at a sign like that, it needs to think about it, it needs to express an opinion that reflects its own answer based on life to that all-important question, now that it is once again possible to ask it in a public way, in a public place. If Steve's comments have been of interest, I hope he won't mind my mentioning his website, simple to remember, visitsteve.com, but also Crossing the Line and so forth will allow you to pursue any interest you have in this remarkable kind of artistic work blossoming here in the United States. In the time that remains, let me do as I always do at this part of the program, which has to do with responding to your comments, questions, the emails that you send in, again, to rdwolf@2fs.com or to democracyatwork.info, our two websites. We were discussing last time, and it's taken a while, and I wanted to stretch it out over a few programs. What is capitalism? Well, couldn't be more appropriate to what we've just been discussing with Steve. And in the last two parts of this discussion, we focused on the following, that it really won't do to think of capitalism as private enterprise and say socialism as public, because as we showed last week, the things we think of as capitalist societies have lots of public enterprise, and the things we think of as socialist societies have lots of private enterprises, and we gave plenty of examples last week of both. And likewise, we found the distinction between capitalism and socialism based on capitalism being where markets work and socialism being where national planning works is equally inadequate, because lots of planning goes on in so-called capitalist societies, and lots of markets have always existed in every known socialist society, so that it really doesn't work. Well, with that behind us, we're left with the question, how might we distinguish, how ought we to distinguish capitalism from its alternatives, and particularly the alternative of socialism? And I think the answer is the following. It's how you organize the actual enterprise, the place where the goods and services we all depend on are produced. How do you do that? How do you organize the activity? It's not a minor matter. Most adults spend most of their lives at work in the enterprise, whatever it is, public or private, mediated by markets or by planning. We go to work, typically Monday through Friday,
9 to 5, more or less, that's what we do. And we spend a much of the rest of our lives either preparing for the work experience or recuperating from it in the afternoon or the evening, in front of the TV, with a beer, or however we do it. So the organization of enterprise is no minor matter. It's where we spend our lives. How does the capitalist system organize enterprises? It has an owner. In a typical modern capitalist corporation, the owners, the major owners, are the major shareholders, the handful of people who own the big blocks of shares. They select the leaders of the corporation. We call them boards of directors. They're selected by the major shareholders. And together, the major shareholders and the board of directors they select, they make all the key decisions. What to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits generated by the production of whatever they make, good or a service. That's the capitalist way. The socialist way is different. If we at least pay attention to Marx's work, and he remains the major theorist here, his idea, developed by others since, goes this way. No, the enterprise is going to be organized differently. We're going to democratize the enterprise. All the people who work in an enterprise are going to democratically, together, decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that, after all of them helped to produce. Now, there's a radical difference. No confusion, no ambiguity. This has got nothing to do with public or private, market or plan. This has to do with how you organize the enterprise. Is it going to be a capitalist, top-down, hierarchical, undemocratic arrangement? Or is it going to be a democratic arrangement in which all of the stakeholders, all of the people whose lives are wrapped up in an enterprise, participate equally and democratically in making the decisions? There's a dividing line between capitalism and socialism, or communism, if you like, that is clear. And that lays down a kind of gauntlet to people who want to think systematically about system differences, having realized that the conventional way, public versus private, market versus plan, doesn't cut it. How different was it in the Soviet Union? Let's be real concrete here. When the private enterprise, led by the major shareholders and the board of directors, was eliminated, and in the place, a group of government officials came in, and they ran the enterprise. The mass of workers remained excluded from the participation in the decisions of the enterprise. And likewise, in the United States, what is it we mean when we have private enterprise system, and yet it is the government that decides such minor matters as how much money there'll be, what the interest rate will be, what you're allowed and not allowed to do in a whole array of areas, what is the minimum wage you must pay, what is the tax that the government will take from you. The role of the state in shaping and governing in our quote-unquote private enterprise system is as massive as the private continuing qualities in a quote-unquote socialist society ever were. So we need new definitions because the old ones don't work. And if we want to be clear about what's happening, that's the least we ought to do. Finally, for today, I want to respond to a person who sent in a very simple question. And the question was, what is happening to American households from an economic standpoint? Well, it's a very big question, but an interesting reality is at the end of August this year, the U.S. Census Bureau issued a report on what has been happening to families. And this question led me to read that report
And there are many, many interesting things. I urge you to take a look at it. It was a report based on the American Community Survey and the current population survey, two very basic surveys of the American condition that are gathered and processed by the U.S. Census Bureau. But here are just a few in the hopes that you will get interested and perhaps pursue this report, dated August 28th, for yourself. First, married couples in America. Between 1970 and 2012, married couples with children dropped from 40% of our households to 20. A 50% drop. Over the same period of time, the households in which one adult lives alone doubled to 27%. So let's be clear. In 2012, a much larger number of households had one person living alone than had two people with children. The conventional notion of what the conventional American family or household looks like is, in fact, a small minority of what we actually have. The total number of households in the United States is numbered at 115 million. Out of that, the number of households in which same-sex married partners live is 605,000. We've had a national debate for years about a kind of household that amounts to less than 1% of the households in our society. Something perhaps you would like to think about. 9% of married families live below the poverty line in the United States. 1 out of 10 American families lives below the poverty line. The poverty line in the United States is a level of lack of funds that is unspeakable. It is unbelievably poor. But here's another number. Out of the families, households with a single adult parent, typically a woman, 35% of those families live below the poverty line. We are a society that is becoming very different from the stereotypic images we have had. The facts are there. The surveys prove it. America is not the America of our parents, and it is long overdue that we understand all of the implications of that. I want to thank you all for being with me again. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, your host. Let me invite you once again to follow up on any of these issues and on the interview with Steve Lambert. All of our programs are archived at rdwolf2fs.com. You can hear them all there. And likewise, you can visit us at our other website, democracyatwork.info. I look forward to talking with you again next week.